Hello, my name is Lou Augusta, and welcome to A Rumor of Empathy. Today, my special guest is Rob Volpe, CEO of Ignite 360. Rob is an engaged observer of life and a master storyteller, bringing empathy and business insight to human experience and to the world's leading consumer brands, products, services. I think you can see the relevance of empathy to engaging and grasping consumer preferences, feelings, thinking, behavior, needs. Rob, by the way, has encapsulated his insights and his experiences and his stories in a new book. Back cover, front cover. Tell me more about that. Solving the Empathy Crisis, One Conversation at a Time. Rob, welcome to the show.
Lou, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here and to have time to speak with you.
Great to have you. So let's get into this thing. I mean, best practice. You've got a lot of material here, a lot of great stuff. And best practice, let's define our terms up front. How do you define empathy?
Well, isn't that just the sort of million-dollar question these days? And actually, something that I find a lot of people get confused with. Lou, when I ask that question, if I'm giving a presentation or a talk, I'll always ask the audience, like, how would you define empathy? And I typically get three answers. I get seeing the point of view of somebody else, and then I hear feeling the feelings of somebody else with them or as them, and then I get walking a mile in somebody else's shoes. And from what I've been able to discern and the way I view the world, all of those answers are correct, because empathy is multifaceted. There's cognitive empathy and emotional empathy. One is perspective taking, one is about feeling feelings. And so, yeah, those are both empathy. Empathy is ultimately about connecting with another human being to better understand who they are and what they're experiencing from their perspective.
Mm-hmm. About connecting with another human being to understand who they are and what they're experiencing from their perspective. I mean, I'm just making sure I get it. I actually read the book cover to cover, and you do call out cognitive empathy.
Yes.
And that's, I think, very important. I'm just probing a little bit here. What other aspects of empathy are important, or do you apply, find useful, implement?
I mean, for myself, why I took the book in the direction of, you know, focusing more on cognitive empathy is because that's what you use in your day-to-day life more often. It's much harder for a lot of people to step into the feelings of somebody completely other than them and to really feel what they might be feeling. And it's also uncomfortable. Some people are not really, you know, feeling safe to explore emotions or to be down in that emotional space. Emotions are very powerful. People don't always know what to do with them, how to harness it, to turn it into something. And yet really what we're needing to do is see the point of view of somebody else, understand where they're coming from. If they're having a bad day, or you're just having a disagreement, or even if you're agreeing with them, just talking to them and asking where they're coming from. The analogy that I've started using, and if anybody in your audience is a sort of paleontologist or paleoanthropologist, I'm going to mix up a whole lot of things, but it'll paint the picture and hopefully help people understand. I talk about emotional empathy. If you go back to when we were living in caves, in cave dwelling times, emotional empathy is what you have with the people that are in your cave. They're your family, your closest of friends, the people where you have very similar rituals, beliefs, values, and lifestyle. Cognitive empathy is what you use when the people from the cave down the road come over and they want to talk to you about this new thing that they've invented called farming. And they want to clear the land in front of the caves, and they want to plant things, to grow things, and you're not really understanding exactly what that is, but you can relate to the idea that they want to provide for their family, and that they want to provide for the people in their cave. And therefore, because you can see their perspective, you're going to be able to have a better conversation. You're going to be able to collaborate. You might even be able to problem solve together and go, oh, hey, I've got this tool over here that's got this like wedge to it. We could drag that through the ground. And wouldn't that make it a lot easier to turn the dirt and grow the things you want to grow? That's what empathy ultimately can enable. And that's all based on cognitive empathy. Emotional empathy will get you and empowers many of the same skills and traits, but it's, again, people are a lot more uncomfortable getting into that emotional space. So to me, it's like, if we can focus on cognitive empathy as a starting point to just try to understand where somebody's coming from, the world's going to be a much better place.
So the uses of empathy in agriculture, And one thing you said up front in the book that really engaged my attention, I think you were quoting some other celebrity entrepreneur, but I had not seen the idea anywhere else. By all means, take a walk in the other person's shoes, in the, you know, take a walk in the other person's moccasins, so to speak. But don't forget to take off your own shoes.
Yes.
I must say, I really did a double take on that, because I have never, I mean, I've been working on empathy for a long time in one form or another. I've never heard that before. Even if the guy from, what was it, Intuit.
Yeah, Steve Case from Intuit said that.
So we'll give him a shout out on this.
Yeah, exactly.
But take off your own shoes, because if I don't take off my own shoes, what happens then?
Yeah, well, you're going to rip those other shoes apart, or they're not going to fit, which means you're not going to get to a place of empathy. And to me, it represents that necessary step of dismantling our judgment. Judgment is like the shoes that we wear, and that's why it's the first step in the five steps to empathy that I talk about and bring to life in the book. I also feel that is the biggest hardest challenge for most people to overcome, is actually not being judgmental in the moment.
Well, that's really significant. I mean, I think we're going to delve more in detail into that, because that goes to the heart of your contribution and the contribution of the subtitles itself. I think I said it, but say it again, solving the empathy crisis one conversation at a time. Say more about, if you could, what is this thing, judgment? How does it play in relation to empathy? What's going on here with this?
Yeah, so, you know, judgment is something that we've developed over time. We're hardwired to make judgments. And also, I think, to be judgmental. It's part of how we organize ourselves and keep people that are other away. But now we live in a society where it's our otherness that we need to get in touch with and celebrate and relate to in order to have a productive society. We don't live in these monolithic cultures that we did, you know, even 60, 70 years ago. So judgment, and there's two types of judgment. There's making a judgment, which is a decision that you might be making. I'm not going to go down that dark alley. I'm going to wear the blue shirt today. Those are all judgment calls. And that's okay. You need to do that. So I'm not advocating against that. What I'm advocating against is casting aspersion. Mm-hmm. It's when we're being judgmental against other people. The slights that you hear or see on social media or in the media or in our everyday communication with each other and our interactions, that's all being judgmental. And that gets in the way of empathy. You can't you can't see somebody for who they truly are and where they're coming from if you've got these blinders of judgment. I talk about it. I love analogies. And so, you know, in the beginning of the book, I talk about it like a brick wall. And it's just this impenetrable thing. You can't scale over it. All you can hope to do is try to dismantle it. And really, the only way to do that is to catch yourself when you are about to be judgmental, either in thought or in spoken or written word, and go, wait, where is that coming from? Why am I doing this? What's to what end? What's the benefit of that? And try to think about that other individual in a different way that's not with judgment, and being open and being curious to who that person is.
Well, this matter of judgment is huge. I know, I mean, I want to keep out of your way, but you know, both of us have spent some time in the corporate world, and I never underestimate the power of empathy. Empathy, capitalist tool, I think, was what you saw that and made you reach out to me in some ways. But in the matter of judgment, can we get personal?
Sure.
I think our listening audience, the listening audience would be interested to hear from you. And we're going to continue. You're a storyteller. The book contains a lot of stories. Yeah. They contain stories about Ignite 360, but they also contain heartwarming, moving, confronting stories about your clients and the people you interact with, and also is what personal material shows up there. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal book in many ways. I think that tends to make it a bit of a page turner. But here's a question. What events or experiences persuaded you or brought you to the importance of empathy? How did you get to this subject?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really goes all the way back to my childhood, growing up in a small town in Indiana, about 13,000 people. And my family had moved into that town when I was going into fifth grade. And the kids decided within a few weeks, I mean, it was fall, it must have been late September, early October of fifth grade. The kids decided that I was other. And that one of the kids in particular, and it was interesting when I was reading your book, Lou, and I was going through, you list out all the different types of bullies. And I'm like, which ones of my bullies, where did all of them fall? And I had several across the different quadrants there. But one of the kids had decided that I was going to be in competition. His mom had told him that I would be in competition with him one day to be valedictorian. He tells me that one week. Huh. The next week he comes in and announces that I'm gay. And that catches on like wildfire in my school. And this is 1980 small town Indiana. So, you know, it's before the AIDS crisis. There's really not much that's known about homosexuals, the LGBTQ community in small town Indiana, except it's this other thing and it's to be derided. And so the kids, yeah, I mean, life became a living hell for me for years. And I started to, unbeknownst to me, I started to use empathy as a survival skill. Yeah. And I started to realize as I was paying attention to how rumors would start and spread, and you know, how awful it was when a rumor would start on like a Monday or Tuesday or even a Wednesday. Yeah. But if I could make it to like Thursday or Friday, yeah, it'd be okay, because you know, it was only a couple of days till the weekend and it didn't have as much time to fester and boil over. Yeah. But along with that, and those observations of people and behavior, I also noticed that if I was able to be friends with some of my classmates, or at least get along with them and hear their stories and listen to whatever was going on in their life, they were going to be less likely to join the pile on, so to speak, when a rumor did get started.
Yeah.
And so over the years, things got better. It's still, I didn't get out of there, you know, sort of scot-free, I guess, so to speak. But by the time I'd gotten into later into high school, I was the high school yearbook editor. I was in the drama club. I was co-captain of the swim team. I was a senior class speaker. There were a lot of things that I was able to do and kind of achieve, but empathy helped me early on make it through that kind of dark period.
Well, I mean, what I get from that is, first of all, you had some challenging stuff to survive. Just to use a technical term, there was really some shit coming at you.
Yep.
It's almost impossible to put words on it. I make bad behavior is trending. But if you want to see it, there's no excuse for it. And children of tender age, you're in fifth grade, they can be very cruel. This is absolutely no excuse. And it does sound like what you're experiencing is just a sexual preference among others. Here's just a straight up question, a point of information. Did you even know what the word gay meant?
No, I
very
had
interesting.
To
That's
go
very
home
interesting.
And yeah. I mean, I had to go home and ask my mom what gay was. And, why are you asking this question? And back then, I mean, God, I remember my early I knew there was something different about me. I knew I wasn't like the other boys, but I didn't understand what that was or how that was at that particular age. And then you started, I'd read some articles in magazines, occasionally there'd be a character I might see on TV, but back then the portrayals were not very flattering of people in the community. And so no, I didn't know. And it's not like I got caught making out with, another classmate behind the barn or behind the gym. I was just sitting in Mr. Dunahay's fifth grade spelling class, and all of a sudden, boom, the anvil dropped.
It sounds like that this guy who's saying we're competing to be valedictorian lacked a certain sportsmanlike spirit of competition.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hitting below the belt. I'm being sort of simple-minded here. Forgive me. I mean, I'm being sort of stupid. But, compete, okay, but it's like, give me a break, man. And I do know, so that's what you had to survive.
That's what I had to survive.
Not trivial. That is nothing trivial. You may usefully know yourself. I mean, this is just... as a survivor, this is just a thought. It's not the truth with a capital T, but many people are, and sometimes they understand that and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's difficult. And I really appreciated how much you opened up and shared about your own experiences, being bullied in your book, and different situation, obviously, but I appreciated that honesty. And, back then, I write about it in the book, I was very open about it. I did have some suicidal thoughts in fifth and sixth grade. And like, what am I doing? Why is this even worth it? Fortunately, I didn't, have the internet. I didn't have social media egging me on or making things even worse. And that plus understanding like, wow, that would, if I were to do that, that would be really devastating to my parents and my grandparents. And I couldn't put them through that. And that kept me, in a place from really taking action and attempting anything. But it was dark, and I relate to teenagers today and the struggles that they go through, and it would have been even harder. I don't know how they do it. I have a lot of
empathy. I would have
empathy, really. Yeah, with
and sympathy both.
Today. Yeah. Yeah, and compassion for what teens go through today. Because and the sort of meta narrative of the book because you're right. I intentionally use narrative learning as an approach, but my own story is kind of the bigger meta arc of it. And as I worked to get to a place of forgiveness with my classmates, which empathy helped me do, it never forgave what, or excused, I should say, what they did, but I was able to use empathy to understand where they were coming from. Mm-hmm. Once I finally, as an adult, was able to understand what they were experiencing and realizing that what they were doing had really nothing to do with me. Maybe for the first kid, because he was wanting to, you know, throw out the competition. And he did end up becoming one of our valedictorians. But it still ended up, you know, fine, I was senior class speaker, I got the longer speech, woohoo. But I was able to understand what my classmates were going through. And I used empathy as I was listening to them during a high school reunion. I was able to understand where they were coming from and what might have been going on and how much of this was really about them and their pain. And they were just lashing out at me because I was there.
Well, understanding is always a valuable asset. And it sounds like your understanding had to grow rapidly and perhaps even in ways beyond your fifth grade years in order to survive the gauntlet of, at least it sounds like it was verbal abuse. I don't know. I mean, sometimes this stuff results in kids getting into wrestling matches and fisticuffs too. But basically, I mean, I think you know that the psychology of what is it called? Homophobia. There's a psychology of homophobia is the technical term. The guy who says, "You're gay, ma'am," like this is something bad, right?
Right.
Well, you know what the psychology is.
Yeah.
That's keeping down. Yeah. I love boys.
Yeah.
I think I love you, man. I mean, you're not feeling the love here. I mean, I'm being, you know,
yeah.
I mean, just to make not to put a too fine a point on it. I mean, that would really, I don't recommend you necessarily bring that up if you're outnumbered in the context.
Correct.
You know, but in terms of, you know, truth and whatever you want to call it, reconciliation, stand up and say what you've done wrong and make a request for forgiveness, and the survivors will say whether they're, based on the truth, whether they're able to forgive.
Yeah.
But so make no mistake. I mean, I want to give a shout out. This is an academic book, but I believe the late Elizabeth Young Broyle, I hope I haven't killed her off prematurely, on all different kinds of prejudices, the anatomy of prejudice. Mm. I give a shout out here. And the guy who, the man or woman who's, "You're a gay man," like this would, you know, not be your best feature, let's say.
Right.
Like, he likes you a lot. Yeah. And in a way that is deeply distressing to him. Like there's a sexual dimension of desire there. Well, you want to, you know, I mean, 5-year-old sex, this is like, you know, we don't need to go there. It's sort of fantasy land anyway, but
it is, you know, it's threatening to them. Yeah. Because they either recognize that in themselves, you know, if they are starting puberty, which back then in fifth grade, boys really weren't that I was aware of.
Agree. It would have been a little, it's not too early to start being mean. It's not too early to start being a mean kid.
Oh no, absolutely. And so, yeah, I avoided physical confrontation. I mean, I had received, my parents were on a plane flight once and they happened to be sitting next to a psychologist who suggested that all I needed to do was haul off and hit the kid and that would shut everything down. And okay, yeah, that might actually do that. And I've heard of that working, but that goes against every sort of thing that I'm about in terms of being physically violent. So that didn't really seem like a solution. And I managed to talk my way out of any time somebody threatened to hurt me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I got it. I mean, I acknowledge your courage in sharing this. And, you know, those listeners who want further details, they should buy and read the book in any case. But there's the one question I do have, and we can segue to the many other narratives and stories. Your book
absolutely
is chock full of great material. And this is a powerful narrative. I mean, it is who you are. And it turns out, you know, I get it. You weren't the kind of kid to haul off and slug somebody else. It's a risky proposition in any case.
Right.
But here's a question, which is at another level. Granted, you may have been using empathy and limit setting, trying to set boundaries, trying to figure out, you know, where the community boundaries are. When do you remember, if you remember, when did you actually first encounter the distinction empathy as a word, empathy, like as the idea?
Oh, wow. You know, I don't remember a specific time. It's just always been present, but in the background, I guess. And people didn't really talk to me about my own empathy skills necessarily. I think when it came roaring back to life for me was in 2010, when the University of Michigan study came out that found they'd done this meta-analysis of it's the study of studies. They did this meta-analysis of 76 universities looking at their student life surveys every year from 1979 through 2009. And they found that from 1979 through 2001, there was a 40% decline in students' ability to have empathy, to see the point of view of their classmates. And CNN picked that story up. And I remember I was on a business trip and hearing that story, you know, on CNN, and then you see it on the ticker. And it's like, oh my God. So, you know, that was 2001 when they hit the decline, and then it stayed at that level for the final 8 years of the study. But I'm like, if you were in college in 2001, in 2010, you're in your late 20s, early 30s, like you're a member of society. You're working, you may be partnered, you may be a parent, you're somebody's neighbor, and you have less empathy. That's a problem. And we've just continued to see that play itself out in more and more ways as we've become further and further isolated from each other in our algorithmic bubbles, thanks to social media and the ways that we're engaging with each other. And yeah, I mean, we just did a study earlier this year where we asked the same question that was in the University of Michigan study, what they were looking at of, can you easily see the point of view of other adults? 1/3 of American adults could not agree with that statement. I can easily see the point of view of others. It's like 1/3 of the people you're going to run into today, if you're out and about, like 1/3 of the people that come across your path are not going to easily be able to see your point of view. What does that mean if you need help? What does that mean if you need to, you know, communicate with somebody, if you've got a dispute that you need to resolve? That's very concerning to me. And that's why I refer to it as an empathy crisis that we're in. So to answer your question, it was about 2010 when it suddenly was like, light bulb went off, like, oh my God, there's a huge empathy problem. And something that came so naturally and so easily to me, other people were just lacking.
Well, the evidence is there. I mean, you make your case. It is very concerning. And anybody that doesn't, you know, really see the point may usefully turn on the local news, if not the national news or the international news. So since this is not a softball interview, what do you propose to do about it? Let's talk solutions for a moment. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth,
No, So
I'll give you a chance to just respond. And I do have an idea of what you think the solution is. But first, I'd like to hear what you think the solution or, you know, well, the solution. It's not like the, it's like some things that could be done to improve a very challenging situation.
Absolutely. And you know, as we were starting to face it at Ignite 360, we had more and more clients because we're in the business of building empathy between our clients and their consumers to understand who they are. And, you know, it's when you're working in, you know, quote unquote, the ivory tower, when you're in corporate America, you probably have an advanced degree of some sort. You've got, you know, the six-figure salary. You aren't necessarily the same individual as the person that's consuming your product or your service. And so you really do have to work to see their point of view and understand where they might be coming from so that you can build better products, services, and communications. So empathy is really critical. And it's just cognitive empathy that we're talking about. But the thing that was starting to happen in around 2013 or so, we started having clients come to us wanting more empathy building engagements. They wanted it quick and they wanted it cheap, but they wanted it to be effective. And it's like, okay, you want to go out and get some empathy. What can we do? How can we make this an actual thing? And so we started to develop some different tools and games that we created and curated. But we kept noticing that people still had problems connecting with the consumer. They weren't being able to get to a place of empathy. And so we started looking at why. What was it that was getting in their way? And that's ultimately from that understanding and observing our own behaviors, consulting with psychologists, we started to think about like, what are the things that get in people's way to get to empathy? Because at the same time, others, I think, were inspired by that 2010 study out of the University of Michigan. Political discourse was starting to fall apart. And so you were hearing people say, well, you've just got to, you know, have empathy. You've got to go to the restaurants that the other person goes to, watch the news that the other person goes to or watches, you know, listen to the music that they listen to. That's all fine and good. But to Steve Case's point, if you don't take your shoes off first, if you don't dismantle your judgment, you're never going to have a positive experience where you're going to understand where that person's coming from. And so what we found was missing was that how do I actually get to empathy? What are the things I need to be aware of in the moment that I'm engaging with somebody else to try to get to a place of empathy? And that's where we identified the five steps, which, you know, really quickly, dismantle judgments, the first one. And the second one is ask good questions. And this is about active listening, being present, hearing what the other person has to say. And then you move into integrating into understanding, which is recognizing that there are different ways to view the world and to behave. And it's okay. You need to be curious to understand that and make room in your head for that other point of view. While also recognizing, because another fear people have with empathy is that they think, oh, if I'm going to have empathy with somebody else, I've got to give up my own perspective and my own point of view. And that is absolutely false. So dissuade that notion from people. It's about integrating it into your understanding. It's making room in your head. I like chocolate ice cream. You like vanilla ice cream. And that's okay. If I can be curious about why you like vanilla ice cream, I might learn a thing or two. And that final step, the fifth step, is use solution imagination. So that is when you are imagining yourself as somebody else and using that to propel the conversation or the interaction to a more positive outcome.
Well, I would have answered, I mean, that's great. And I'm glad we got to the five steps. I want to possibly hear, I mean, if it works for you, hear more about those five steps. But I also want to answer the solution. I mean, if I were to look at the book, the solution seems to consist in telling stories.
Absolutely. And listening. And listening to stories.
Well, thank you. That's an important thing, too. I mean, yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, that gets a little bit subtle here, but the listener creates the telling. Without the listener, there's no telling.
Yeah.
listener brings forth the narrative in the sense that if there were no listener, you know, it'd be like the tree that falls in the forest. Nobody's there. Of course, molecules move in the air. There may be dust in the wind in the air, but there's no sound. There's no human sound. So I wonder if it would make sense. I mean, in the book, you know, you've got, in addition to your own, I would say, moving and inspiring and engaging narrative, you've got stories about, well, of course, up top, Hoosier intolerance and bullying, with apologies to the Hoosiers who may be listening to this. I think they've been trying to clean up their act. You know, the woman who is doing Tai Chi, the aging boomer, the disgusting food, the grassy taste of the milk. You've got all kind of the request to somebody to approve or disapprove, and the person is physically challenged. They don't have thumbs on their hand. So, I mean, create a context for me here. What narratives or stories did you find to be the most powerful breakdowns, the most powerful breakthroughs, or the most relevant? I mean,
as I sat down and started thinking about the book and working on the book, there were certain stories, certain experiences that I'd had as a market researcher. And, you know, I think doing qualitative research is such a gift. For somebody that enjoys hearing stories and telling stories, like, there's no better job, especially as an ethnographic researcher, where I get to go into people's homes and find out how they live and, you know, poke around and, you know, with their permission, obviously, but I get to see how others live, and it's not what you would think. So using those, I started thinking about, like, okay, what is it about those stories? I mean, like any story, there's tension and payoff and everything. What was it about those stories that related back to me and my trying to have empathy? Like, why were those things coming up? And when I started looking at the stories from that perspective, beyond just sheer entertainment value, it started to all come together, and I saw how they were starting to line up against the five steps. And my own failures a lot of the time, and things that I learned in trying to be more empathetic and being observant of judgment getting in my way, or you know, times where if I asked some good questions, where that could lead and what that could open up, or the times when I was paying attention or not paying attention, and the things that you might miss in somebody's home. So the stories are critical. And I wanted to write a book that I wanted people to read. And I connected, you talk about it in the introduction or the foreword to Empathy Lessons, where you were like, I'm not going to do an academic book. I've done that. No. I want to write a book people are going to enjoy. I'm going to tell stories. And so I think I went even further with the narrative nature of it. But I knew that narrative was a way that people learn. And it has a way of getting inside your head instead of a textbook where it's more of that rote sort of learning. With the narrative, it's stories that stay with people, and they may, you know, as you had mentioned, it becomes a page turner. You want to find out what happens next. I read the story of Frank often when I'm doing a book reading. He appears in a chapter called Mother Would Never Do That.
And well, tell us about that. Say more. Give us that one. It's very powerful. That's a powerful thing.
Thank you. Yeah. So we were doing a project. We were in Pennsylvania. I was about to go. I went on an in-home and, you know,
an in-home being you visit the client with your own client. You visit the consumer with your own client. Tell us, give us the setup here.
The whole setup. Yeah. So we were doing a study to understand dry package sides. So think Betty Crocker potatoes, Rice-A-Roni, Kraft mac and cheese. And
this is making me hungry here. That's my only complaint. I'm sorry. Back to you.
It's actually a thing that happens when you do studies on food products and you're writing the report. Suddenly you start to crave the product that you've been spending all this time thinking about and writing about, which is fine when it's a dinner side dish, but when it's a cookie project, which I've done plenty of, that's when the waistline gets into jeopardy.
There's real risk in your profession, sir.
There is. There are hazards to the job, for sure. In this particular case, we were going to see a guy named Frank. And so what typically happens on a research project, we'll, you know, choose, I don't know, a dozen, 16, 24 different individuals. And in when you need to understand how they're using a product at home, it's best to go to their home and have an in context, as we would call it, conversation, because then you can see them use the product. They can show you where they store it in their house. You can see the other things in their home that paints a much more complete picture of who they are than if you were to just have them come to a focus group or even just do like a Zoom call. So in context, in-home ethnographies, super powerful. They tend to be like two and a half hours long. In this case, we go to this guy, his name's Frank, go to Frank's house. And like from the time we pulled up, it was one of these old kind of brick homes that you find often in Pennsylvania and Maryland. And it just like, I got this like flash of The Silence of the Lambs when like Jodie Foster pulls up to this house and it's all brick and two-story and kind of creepy looking. And, you know, so that like flashes in my head while I've got, like, I'm at the wheel of our Ford Expedition. I've got a couple of clients with me. I've got a videographer with me because we're video recording the conversation. And Frank comes out and he's very jovial. He's in his late 40s, maybe early 50s. I can't remember. And you know, really nice, invites us in. We go into his house. And as we walk into the home, one of the first things that strikes me is that there's all these 2x4s and exposed beams without drywall on them. Like they're walls up, but there's no drywall on them. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned that he had been in a renovation process in his house. I'm like, oh, okay. Except he had like put objects out on display on like the cross 2x4s. So he was decorating. There was no sawdust. There were no tools anywhere. He had moved in to his renovation basically. And it's like, this is unusual, odd, weird, use your judgmental term. And then as we kept talking, he was a nice guy, was single.
And you're setting your judgments aside just to do the, if I may interrupt you, just to do the five steps. You're having all these judgments
I should set it aside.
You're trying anyway.
I should be. Yeah. I was younger in my career and less aware of all these things that were going on. And, you know, honestly, sometimes you just get triggered. Stuff like, you know, flies up and you've got to work even harder. And yeah, in that case, like, okay, fine, I can put all that aside. And then we're talking. And at one point, I kind of wonder, like, oh, I wonder if is Frank gay? Maybe, I don't know. And that thought like pops in and out. And I might have mentioned, you know, dropped my husband in conversation or some other clue because, you know, I don't get to talk to gay men in my research projects very often. And it'd be kind of nice to, you know, have that connection, and it makes the interview a little easier because then there's a bit of a shorthand. But anyway, one thing that he does, and I point out in the book, I use some of the transcript from the conversation. His parents had been passed away for like 10 years or so, but he referred to his mom as mother, and it was mother this, mother that, and mother was very involved in teaching him how to cook, and he uses mother's recipes, and he makes things the way mother did. And it's just stood out to me as odd as the exposed 2x4s did, as the like kind of house did. Like, why is he referring to her as mother? Like, it just, I would expect it from if we were down in the deep south, but in Pennsylvania, I didn't really hear people use that term very often. So, you know, just another little thing that's going on. And then, and I don't want to tell everything that's in there, but there were a few other clues that happen as I like go to the bathroom, which there's only one bathroom that's upstairs. And then, you know, what I discover in one of the bedrooms that makes me start to wonder, like, are we going to find mother down in the basement? Is she like, you know, preserved like Norman Bates in Psycho? Or, you know, what's who is this guy? And I became fixated. My judgment got in my way. And I became fixated on figuring out what Frank's story was, to the point where I actually, there was one other person that was with us, which was another colleague of mine who was a junior moderator, and he was learning how to moderate. And I let him step in. I kind of just threw the rest of the interview to him. I was like, here, you take over. We're doing the cooking part. This is a good thing for you to get some experience on, because I'm going to go look around his house a little bit more. And so I'm like, you know, he's in the kitchen with the clients and the videographer and my colleague. And I step back and I'm looking around, and I never open drawers unless they're opened for me. So I wasn't, you know, snooping truly, but I was observing and seeing, like, you know, what were in the photos that he had on display. Oh, he's on a beach. It looks like he's on vacation, and it's a photo of him by himself. So who took that picture? Like, is there a partner involved? You know, there was never a photo that would indicate, oh, this was an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend or a gaggle of friends or something. So I just judgment. And I finally find the clue to end all clues. I had noticed earlier that he had a Steve Austin $6 million man action figure sitting on the sink with Mardi Gras beads wrapped around its neck, which
let
was
me, let me. There was a glitch in my audio. A Steve Austin $6 million action man. Figure.
Action
a figure. $6 million yeah. man, which was a 1980s or something show. Every episode, the $6 million man would. It said didn't have X-ray vision, but it was sort of like X-ray vision. We've got the technology. So he had an action figure with some kind of beads. Say again.
Mardi Gras beads. Mardi Gras beads. So he had these green Mardi Gras beads wrapped around Steve Austin's neck. And it's like, who does that? Like, okay, what's going on here? But again, I'm like, going back to my thought earlier, like, is Frank gay? And then I find on one of the 2x4s, I find this little tiny beaded coin purse that's actually beaded, and it's next to a lady's purse, which I'm presuming might have been mother's. But then there's this rainbow flag coin purse. So the beading is in a rainbow flag. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he is gay. And, you know, it's not like I can turn around and go, you know, hey, yo, Frank.
I don't know why.
girl. But it's like, wow, all right. And so when we left, and this is an example of how judgment gets in your way. When we left and we got in the car, first I had to tell the clients, like, oh my God, I figured it out. I figured his story out. But I hadn't heard anything that he had to say, because my judgment wasn't letting me listen to and gather the insights that I was being paid to gather at that point around, you know, side dishes and why he was making what he was making. I couldn't even participate in the debrief conversation because I had gotten myself so fixated on what his story was that really had nothing to do, wasn't relevant to what we were trying to do on that particular project. And it was an example of judgment getting my way. That was a huge brick wall that I just kept adding layers and layers and layers to rather than actually dismantling.
Well, the takeaway for my part is something like, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. The conversation in my head is so loud.
Yes. Oh, I love that.
You know, that's kind of the exercise that you're proposing. Yeah. There are a couple of other spoiler alerts in this story, which I will not go into, which are, you know, align up with some of the more, you know, I mean, interesting, shall we say, some of the more suspenseful movies that are out there. We're not going to go there. Right. And it's, you know, there are no more spoiler alerts, here's the empathy training, right? I mean, you catch yourself in the act, and it's like, my head is a bad neighborhood. If I go there, I'm going to get mugged. So be careful, stay out of certain parts of that neighborhood. And I mean, it's not like an on off switch. Empathy is like, I turn it on, turn it off, but I can dial it down, dial it up, dial it down. And if I can quiesce that conversation, then I can be with who he is as a, you know, in this case, as a consumer of certain products in which your own clients are interested. How do people use this stuff? This is a very powerful story because it's like with the exposed structure of the, you know, there's no wallboard of, you have the struts or the 2x4s, the horizontal, the vertical, you see, it's like you see the house is the self and you see some of the structure of the self. Yeah. And there may be, you know, I mean, this is not group therapy, this is consumer market research. Nevertheless, it turns out they may be more similar than one would have thought.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, say more about that. I mean, we have more time. I mean, take it.
Many a respondent have said to me over the years when they finish a session with me, wow, that felt like therapy. Because, I mean, partly what is therapy? It's somebody listening to you, hearing your stories and having empathy, demonstrating some empathy and having an empathetic connection with you. And, you know, even whether we're talking about, you know, the brand of bottled water you drink or how you prefer to use sexual lubricant, the fact is that they're being heard. And that's what people want and value. And it's what we need and what's sorely lacking in our society today. But yeah, the book is filled with, you know, I don't know, there's 19 chapters, there's at least 19 stories that are in there of these types of adventures that I've had and how I've learned about myself and about empathy and how to be more empathetic in the moment and to help other people learn through those stories. As I mentioned, they just kind of sit with you and then hopefully they come up when you have a moment of interaction. And instead of going to a place of judgment, you're like, well, let me reframe that. Let me ask that question in a different way.
Well, we're getting towards the back end of the conversation here. You're already starting to tell me what are the empathy lessons or the empathy takeaways from, it sounds like years and years of engaged experience with, I mean, with human beings. Yes, it's true. They're consumers. It's good. I mean, I gather you get paid for this. Sorry,
yes.
just being cynical. You know. Nevertheless, what other empathy lessons can you, would be relevant to, you know, I mean, at a higher level, take it up a level for the listening audience?
I think, yeah, number one, we are all humans. We are all doing the best that we can to get through. And we owe it to each other to treat each other the way that we would want to be treated and to hear the stories that we have to share. We are stronger together through those shared experiences. It's how we learn. It's how we come to understand. So I would hope that people can, through reading the book, reflect back on their own experiences and take the opportunity to take a different path in the future. And, you know, at the same time too, I think it's about having forgiveness with yourself. I mean, I said several times in the book, because what I did not want was for people to put me on some sort of a pedestal and be, oh, he's perfect. And, you know, he's the empathy guru or whatever. And I'm like, no, I have an understanding about empathy, but I still wrestle with judgment. It still gets in my way and I have to work on that. I have to make sure I'm doing all the other things. And so to have some grace with yourself, to have some empathy with yourself and understand where you might be coming from so that you can then use that to help understand others.
I mean, that's a powerful point at which to bring it in for a landing. Tell me more about that. Solving the empathy crisis, one conversation at a time. One final thought. A rumor of empathy is no rumor in Rob Volpe's book. Tell me more about that. Empathy lives in Rob Volpe's work and at Ignite 360. See ya next time. Signing off.